Okay, we're back, and it's the pirate planet. We have only had a couple of minutes break since
yeah,
we spoke.
We've had 7 minutes. You've had 7 days. Welcome back.
A week between part one and part two. Is it worth reiterating why we paired the pirate planet with the girl who died and the woman who lived?
Yes. So we're pairing the pirate planet with, in our first part of this episode, the girl who died and the woman who lived. Basically, immortality, campy sci-fi eye patches, precious jewels, and aloof, godlike companions, yay or nay.
Yes, okay. So there's a lot there. It works. It broadly works together.
It broadly works, yeah. So this is what happens when you're 98 episodes into a podcast that pairs new Doctor Who with classic Doctor Who. Sometimes you've already done the ones that maybe suit them better.
Yes. Well, let's do it. So, I appreciated the opportunity of watching The Pirate Planet, so this works fine and dandy for me. I had never seen it.
I thought you said you'd maybe seen it before on UK Gold or something.
Well, yeah, so years and years and years and years. And as I've said before about my UK Gold experience, it was usually done still dozing, hungover from drinking the night before. So this is the first time I've sat down with an interest and fully taken it in.
The first time I saw this was on VHS around a friend's house, mm-hmm. when like me and a couple of other friends in primary school got really into Doctor Who after the TV movie.
Yeah.
And we'd just buy whatever Doctor Who VHSs we could find in like HMV and Boots the Chemists, as I've discussed in earlier episodes, and John Menzies and all that kind of thing. And yeah, so he'd got the Pirate Planet, and that was the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And I've revisited a couple of times since. I also I read James Goss's adaptation of it last summer, I think it was, maybe.
How was that?
It's really good, actually. It's adds some more kind of backstory to the Mentiads and all that kind of thing. So it's a good laugh. James Goss is a really good writer, actually.
I did like City of Death, actually. I really liked that.
Yeah, City of Death's really good. Scratchman, which he wrote with Tom Baker, is amazing.
Yeah.
Just really wonderful.
Okay, well, let's do it. Pirate Planet was written by Douglas Adams. And it was directed by Pennant Roberts. Interesting thing about it, we don't usually do who the producer is. Now, this is in the Graham Williams era.
Mm-hmm.
Graham Williams apparently broke his leg.
Did he break his own leg so he wouldn't have to work with Tom Baker?
But he, I don't know. Did a dog bite Tom Baker, or was it Graham Williams in a dog suit? But so, for all intents and purposes, this was the day-to-day production role was done by script editor Anthony Reed. It was broadcast between the 30th of September 1978 and the 21st of October 1978, and it was watched by an average of about 8.5, 8.6 million. Highest viewing figures were from part one, which was 9.1 million. Lowest, which was for part two, which was 7.4 million.
Right.
There we are, Pirate Planet. Those are the stats. But now, it's
Dexy's Where Did It Come game.
My turn to guess first. Out of 289, where does the Pirate Planet fall in the dynamic rankings poll? This is pretty well regarded, I think. It's sort of classic Douglas Adams in that it has two or three ideas more than it knows what it wants to do with them.
Yeah.
I think, is it Russell T. Davis, I think, once talked about the Pirate Planet and said, I might be combining two things here, but I think he said that a Douglas Adams script was a little bit like the Pirate Planet in the sense that there was just loads of little jewels just scattered around on the streets.
Yeah.
Just discarded, you know, and those are the sort of ideas that the Douglas Adams will just kind of throw out into a story as just like a little add-on, you know. So yeah, I think this is well regarded. It's a lot of fun. It's got it's got some classic moments. I remember early days of my Doctor Who fandom, I think around the time I maybe watched this for the first time, Doctor Who magazine did a kind of feature on the best, was it the best scenes in all of Doctor Who? And one of them was, but what's it for?
Yeah.
You know, which is great. I'm going to go quite high with this one. I think it's probably top 50, although maybe I'm being too, because I mean, currently we're standing at, you're at 5, I'm at 3. So this, I'll stick with top 50. I'm going to go 47. Maybe that's too high. I feel that's too high now. I feel I fucked it.
Yeah, I don't think it's as high as that, but I understand. I'm going to say like 80.
So I'll open the golden envelope. Behold and recognize the ethereal voice of Derek Anderson, a.k.a. the Degzestial Funmaker. And this definitely isn't added in because I forgot to say it on the original recording. I decree the following to be truth. Ahoy there, shipmates. Hopefully that's me not had a bevy for about a month now, which is a callback to the previous episode in which Derek is currently going for a booze-free 100 days, I think he said, wasn't it?
Yes, he did. Yeah, yeah,
so, yeah. So, yeah, all the best with that. Wow. Interesting. Fucking hell. The Pirate Planet comes in at a ridiculously undeserved 110. It's locked between two classics, The Time Meddler at 109 and The Mask of Mandragora at 111. I need a drink now after that fucking bullshit. Yeah. I agree, Derek. I agree as I lose another point this yeah, episode.
Pretty happy with how this is shaping up.
So that's 6-3. Fucking hell. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to really pull it back.
It's all to play for, mate. It's all to play for.
You say that. So, listener correspondent, the People's Poet at Rick P on Twitter says, this is my first viewing of the Pirate Planet. Going back to class of Doctor Who, it takes a few moments to adjust to the shoddy effects, etc. How dare you, Rick? How dare you? Then you just don't care. This is terrific, shouty fun. The standout moment for me was the captain's touching mourning of Mr. Fibuli. My understanding of the First Romana was that she was rather aloof. I didn't see that here. Mary Tam brings a touch of warm humour and intelligence to the role. Plus, she's not afraid to pick up a gun and join in the action. I'm looking forward to seeing more of Romana 1. And Rick asks, is this the point that Tom begins to go off the rails? Well, I mean, who can say? So, sometimes it's hard to tell if he's bored 1 minute and being the utter centre of attention the next. And how many times can he break the fourth wall? Luckily, he's got a fantastic Douglas Adams script to chew on. Yeah, and some scenery to go along with it. Lewis Baston, Pirate Planet is clever but hollow. I see what you did there, Lewis, and I liked it. It's a jokey story about genocide, which is a queasy thing to be. The modus operandi is too close to real genocide for comfort. It's the one story which is actually improved by Tom overacting. What's it for? Gives it a semblance of morality. The guys at Lost on Gallifrey say the Pirate Planet is very much like The Girl Who Died, a good fun episode with some beautiful Tom and Tam chemistry and cracking robot pirates. Well, you can't say further than that. Dylan Reese says the Pirate Planet is scenery chewing madness that drives people who like their sci-fi series mad. Screw those people though. Give me this over Babylon 5 shite that. But I'll start that again. Screw those people though. Give me this over that Babylon 5 shite any day. I agree. Over to Jeff Waddle. The Pirate Planet is fun, but it's not as good as fandom says it is. Certainly one of the better stories in the Key to Time season, but that's not saying much. Brian Purchase lifts the story, but that's about the only good point. J.R. Southall, on a similar note, The Pirate Planet is a dog's dinner of a mess, with Douglas Adams throwing too many ideas at the story that never all quite fit together. Having said that, the better ones really work, and it's shot through with that Adams sense of humour that would soon become very familiar. So it probably looks better here in 2020 than it did back in 1978. The double twist ending, the nature of the piracy and the truth about the nurse, is brilliant. It's a shame there's so many head-scratching moments on the way there. And finally, Rassilon's Trousers. The Pirate Planet is a great showcase for Douglas Adams' incredible imagination and the BBC Effects Department's gallant attempts to keep up with him. It's bringing up brimming with huge ideas, Tom is on form, and the Captain is a gloriously over-the-top villain. Absolutely love it. Quite well liked, but with a few caveats, I think, is I would say about the Pirate Planet. How did you find it first time properly watching it?
There's nothing quite like coming across some new old Doctor Who. This whole Key to Time season is basically that. And I thought it was, I've said this before, that your enjoyment can be gotten out of just being in the right headspace for something. And I think I was in the right headspace for this. And it's interesting. Yeah. Did you say, or did, was it one of the listener correspondents that there's every possibility that this has remained quite attractive and fresh now because of Douglas Adams's ideas and writing and his approach to storytelling, then it may be, because I can maybe imagine that back when it was first broadcast, it might have been considered a bit too complicated. Well, there were
the head of drama and serials at the BBC was not a fan of the script when it was submitted. I think Adams was because he's coming off the back of Hitchhikers at this point, isn't he?
No, so he's during the broadcast of this, he sold the scripts for Hitchhikers,
right, okay,
and so he was writing this simultaneously with Hitchhikers.
Okay.
So this is just jobbing writer Douglas Adams, where I think the only things he'd really done prior to that is, you know. Well, he's one of the very few people that's credited as a writer on Monty Python's Flying Circus that is not the original Six Pythons.
Yeah, sure.
Because he helped, I think he took over the place that John Cleese left as the writing partner for Graham Chapman.
Oh, in series four.
For that six episodes of what was just Monty Python, as opposed to Monty Python's Flying Circus. So this is kind of Douglas Adams with anonymity just doing whatever he fancies doing, but with a lot of the hallmarks of Douglas Adams, it being funny. And yeah, like Tom Baker is doing some scenery chewing here, but it looks like he's also for the first time quite enthused and excited by a script and excited by a production.
Yeah.
And I think that comes across here. So this is the same. This is basically the start of Douglas Adams as we would come to know him after the point.
Yeah, I mean, not just Hitchhikers, obviously Douglas Adams in Doctor Who, because he becomes the script editor kind of off the back of this. In the next series. But I loved going back to this. I mean, it seems bizarre to say this because it's the Douglas Adams script, but I did forget how funny it is.
It is, and it is funny. It is legitimately funny.
Properly funny. And the thing is, because I think what I always remember about the Pirate Planet is the captain, is the Doctor and the captain's kind of confrontation in that kind of weird trophy room that he's got with all the kind of miniature planets. What I forget is just all the little subtle moments. Like, I love part one. I love the Doctor and Romana turning up. Romana grabbing the attention of everybody around her. The Doctor just being looked at like a lunatic and people running away from him and all that kind of stuff. It's just really funny. Like, it's not often you get a Doctor Who story where the Doctor kind of strides into town with, like, confidence and then everybody just recoils in horror.
Yeah.
And doesn't want anything to do with him because he looks mental. That's great. I think that's a really fun spin on your kind of part one.
Well, I mean, you would as well if somebody approached you in the street with a long scarf and that enormous amount of herpes on his face that it looks like he's got.
Yeah, that chunk taken out of his top lip by an angry dog. And actually, that's another thing I quite like about this, is that there's a whole scene at the start of this, which is just a fun bit of business that actually manages to get across that the Doctor and Romana are still getting to know each other, and that she kind of still thinks she's more intelligent than him and better than him, and the Doctor's kind of, I guess, kind of on the defensive, because he kind of knows that's probably actually true.
Yeah.
But then also, is purely written to just cover the fact that Tom Baker had a chunk taken out of his lip by a dog, so he has to bang his head off the console to give him a cut on his lip for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
That's such a deft like script editor touch. I love it. It's just like, can you just write this lovely bit of dialogue?
I think they probably have to, because otherwise it does... I mean, it doesn't look like he's injured himself. You could get away with just like putting that story out in the Radio Times. It does It does look quite sexually transmittedly disgusting, you know.
Well, yes, because was it not in rehearsals or something that happened? Like they went to the pub or something?
Yeah, he was trying to feed a sausage to Paul Seed's dog. Paul Seed, who played the Graf van der Kay in the previous story, the Reboss operation.
That's it, the Reboss operation, yeah.
And so it happened, and they went, oh, fuck, right, we're going to have to... And then he retains it for... I mean, you can see it in pre... And I mean, he even up until season 18, he can see the scar. There's still a scar on his lip with the dog's bit.
Oh, yeah. You're right, when there's a close-up, you're like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Because it's all kind of scabbed over by the time they get into studio. But yeah, I just think this is so full of ideas. And like I say, maybe to its detriment at times. But I think it's... Because it's one of these main things. Like, it's a kind of socialist look at kind of like totalitarian governments where it's just like, you know, it's raining jewels. So we're not really going to ask any questions about where these jewels are coming from.
Yeah, there's a complete idiocy in the population. He's going, oh, the stars change and then we're rich again. And you just go, not even the most, it's just oblivious. It's just, there's not even the most basic exercising of just trying. Does nobody, I mean.
Nobody clearly has any knowledge of kind of astronomy or science
And
I guess not, but. Because the only kind of scientists, I guess, in this is the captain who crash-landed on the planet.
Yeah.
Mr. Fibuli, I'm not entirely sure. Is he part of that original crew that came with the captain?
I don't know. It's never really said who is who in terms of, you know, nativehood to the thing. Because Mr. Fibuli seems to detest the captain in more than just we're from the same race and we work together sort of way. He seems entirely put upon in a kind of, what's the name of the guy who is like the leader of the Earth once the Daleks have taken over in Dalek, Day of the Daleks? Like he's that kind of... You know what I mean? Like, he seems like he's been selected from the population to be the first minister.
I rewatched Gene Wilder's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, well, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and I forgot that the guy who takes over planet Earth, like, at the behest of the Daleks, is the sweetie shop guy at the start of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And I was like, I wouldn't fucking trust him, kids, with your sweeties. He works for the Daleks. He's not to be trusted. He's a right wrong in that boy.
I can't remember the name of the guy, but I think if we're talking about his IMDb, I think I saw him showing up. I've been watching old episodes of Nearest and Dearest, the sitcom.
Blimey.
on YouTube.
Right.
Basically because I read, there's a great comedy resource called The British Comedy Guide, which is about kind of generally everything. And there's a place where there's a guy called Graham McCann who's written a lot of stuff about like Fry and Laurie. And, you know, he's like a comedy historian. Wrote books about Fry, Laurie, Fawlty Towers. And he wrote an essay about Nearest and Dearest, which was this pretty big sitcom, big enough that it got one of these sitcom spin-off movies in the 70s with Hilda Baker and Jimmy Jewell in it. And they, despite it being a huge sitcom and them being seen as this kind of like over a decade, one of the greatest comedy partnerships on TV, detested each other. Honestly, detested each other worse than any annoyance that you've read about in, you know, any sitcom, any movie or whatever. They fucking, there's a double act, hated each other. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll go back and watch some episodes, see if this hatred is viewable in any episodes and stuff. And that's when fucking, oh God, what's instead of just going that what Day of the Daleks guy. Well,
I want to say his name's Aubrey something, but that's
Aubrey
right,
Woods. All, yeah.
Day it is the, Aubrey Woods, is it?
Yeah. I'll just make sure that that is indeed the case. Yeah, Aubrey Woods is the controller in Day of the Daleks, and he was
and
also
the
nearest
first,
and dearest.
The first image of him on Google is from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes. This is not about the Pirate Planet. You can tell that
this is
the
not,
end
sorry.
Of Quantum Mammoth, 3-4 hour recording for us.
The Pirate
yeah,
Planet.
Yes, the Pirate Planet. But yeah, where were we?
But I just think it's... We were talking about kind of how funny it is, the comedy of it. And I think, you know, I think Rick's right. Like, I do think Mary Tam gives Tom Baker a run for his money in terms of the comedy of it.
Yeah, there's
like,
a great...
very funny in it.
There's a great bit where I think, she's being taken, she's kidnapped, and she's being taken in one of those air cars up to the bridge, and it cuts to... her getting in the air car going, shall I sit in the front? Where am I going? Am I sitting in the back? And then cuts to her as the air car is in flight, and she looks like she's on her holidays. She looks like she's having a whale of a time being taken in this air car. It's a great, you know, when I watched that Mythmakers, she said that obviously, you know, towards the end of the series, she felt like Romana would just became a bit of a kind of computerized mouthpiece. But she seems like she's been given some stuff to do in this. Like, there seems like...
Yeah, definitely.
And she's definitely being set up to be the comedy, the buddy comedy element of it is that she is not a know-it-all. She's right.
No, yeah.
She's correct.
Yeah.
And she has a lot... And there's that bit, I think, where in order to make the explanation of Queen Xanxia talking about... being the story of that being told by the Mentiads and the Doctor talking about gestalts and all that kind of stuff, where essentially one speech is split up between Tom Baker and Mary Tam.
Yeah.
It brings her more centrally into this. She's not a normal companion. She's not asking questions. She knows everything. And she's also helping, I don't know, make the information that needs to be explained to the audience and the other characters more accessible than the Doctor and his mouth and his mind running off at different speeds.
Because it's really interesting how this works in that it kind of follows that traditional Doctor Who route of the Doctor and the Companion get split up. The Doctor kind of works everything out and the Companion's like in peril. But actually what happens is they split up, and because it's a Douglas Adams script which has about like 4 or 5 different ideas going on at once, the Doctor and essentially Kimmis, is it Kimmis? The guy?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Yeah. He kind of fulfills the traditional companion role as they kind of go and explore. Well, they kind of discover that they sort of talk with the Mentiads, they sort of discover the captains. They sort of find a way into the captain's control deck, I guess. Whilst Romana kind of comes face to face with the captain and chats to him like quite early on and kind of figures out the kind of science behind what's happening and all that kind of thing. So that actually you kind of get two doctors.
Yeah.
Really. It's kind of like, well, what's a multi-doctor story without actually being a multi-doctor story? And that's a really interesting dynamic. I mean, I get... It is a shame that they don't kind of commit to it and they do kind of turn her into a bit of a standard kind of companion by the end. I was going to actually say that a lot of people, I think, take against Jenna Coleman and Maisie Williams because they don't like sort of characters to be too much like the Doctor. But then I thought, well, actually, Maisie Williams isn't really that good in that two parts, so maybe this isn't the best time to talk about it. Maybe we can talk about this in the finale. This idea that it's slightly misogynistic idea that we've already got one Doctor, we don't need another Doctor.
Yeah.
We don't need the woman to be the Doctor as well. And I do think that's kind of at the root of the whole "not my Doctor" bullshit that we come to have to deal with in our current moment. But I think here, I think the Pirate Planet proves it's utter bollocks. You can absolutely have the Doctor and another and a Time Lady. Let's be traditional about it. Although actually, does she not refer to herself as a Time Lord in this? Am I right?
I think so.
Am I remembering
that
right? I'm sure she said she's a Time Lord. Because actually, I think there's just something really interesting about the dynamic. It's both of them are investigating the situation with a, and they're both on a kind of similar intellectual level. And I don't think you as an audience member ever feel that you're left behind either. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? I don't think it's that John Nathan Turner criticism that, you know, Tom Baker and Lala Ward, it's that, and Douglas Adams, it was that kind of undergraduate university humour that was leaving audiences behind, which, you know, arguably the viewing figures don't quite back up that suspicion. Because actually, I do think it's still quite accessible, just having them together.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I've enjoyed, well, I mean, I didn't really like the Reboss operation when we dealt with that a couple of weeks ago.
No, you didn't, did you? No.
But it was not because of Mary Tam. And I really like the Stones of Blood. And what I really like is that it works because it's two characters. It's one, both of them know how to get the situation remedied. The Doctor is usually kind of like haphazard, slapdash, whatever, seat of the pants kind of stuff. And then you have just this measured, calculated, organizational force, which is Romana. And usually, and within the series, a decent resolution is usually a combination of those two points of view coming together. And I think that's what you get here.
Yeah.
So I don't think that there's I just feel like it's very well laid out in the earliest part of the series that you get, because like Mary Tam is not there's a charming colonial British abroad enjoying the silliness and strangeness of empire. That is her character. She's not an ice queen. She's just somebody
who has a very
clinical, analytical, scientific mind, where the Doctor is very much about sense and touch and feel. And I think that works together. And in the first couple of stories, you get that, and it's great. And I don't think you have her being a know-it-all. But because I think there's a deftness of touch and there's a slightness of humour that goes along with Mary Tam, which means I don't particularly dislike that. I think it's refreshing to see somebody who can be the Doctor without the song and dance that the Doctor gives the character, you know.
Yeah. Well, you said it quite well when we were talking about the Reboss operation. You kind of compared the first Romana to the first Doctor.
Yeah.
And I think you do get that here, and I've touched the third Doctor, that kind of ingratiating charm that Tom Baker doesn't quite have, because he's a bit fucking detached from reality.
Yeah.
So that actually having her there as another Time Lord character, who knows as much as him, but probably more than him, but then also has that kind of ingratiating charm and some of that wit, makes them quite a good team.
Yeah.
I think. Because you're right, there is something really enjoyable in watching a double act, a duo that... one of which is kind of sort of this kind of chaotic good character who kind of is just kind of making do and mend and flying by the seat of his pants, so you say, you know, who is the Doctor? And then there's Romana, who's just like, right, okay, let's figure out the situation, and then we figure out how we're gonna fix it,
you know?
And she's a lot more rational and calculating. And they each kind of learn something from each other. And I think this is definitely, I think, probably the best Doctor and Romana story. I think it's definitely the best one that balances the Doctor and Romana one quite well without kind of sacrificing... Because it's never the Doctor that they kind of you know, sacrifice. It's always Romana. They're always just like, oh, we'll turn her into a bit of a screaming girl for a little bit, just because we don't really know how to deal with her. So yeah, I mean, I really like that about this, is that it does feel, which is quite a rare thing in Doctor Who, that the Doctor and the Companion are on quite equal footing.
Yeah, there's a nice definition to the relationship, but also you can, when you see it done well, you can also understand how precarious a relationship it is, that if a writer is not engaged with trying to give Romana that quiet, nuanced, subtle character, then it's not there. And you can understand why the actor would be annoyed at having to just go through the motions of being...
Even if it's just like, or a jobbing writer hasn't watched Doctor Who for a while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's that as well, I think. There's that kind of idea that there's a certain idea of what Doctor Who is.
Yeah.
But and then... Romana is definitely not that traditional companion character.
Yeah. But then that's where I think Douglas Adams's comedy, a lot of it comes from. It's not in people asking questions. It's people already having the knowledge and then how they use that knowledge. And that's why I think two Time Lord characters are perfect for him to write. Because he can get his head around the idea of, okay, well, if they have the knowledge, what does that do to a character? Whereas a lot of people are like, oh, nah, nobody wants to know it all. And that's what a lot of people would do to Romana One. Yeah. They just made her an Ice Queen know-it-all. And that's not interesting, because they've perceived it. For them, it's not interesting. So I understand why they made Douglas Adams the script editor, because if they were going to continue with the idea of Romana, then they probably needed somebody to marshal that relationship effectively.
Yeah, they want somebody that understands what's good about it.
Yeah.
You know, when they're kind of dealing with the scripts that kind of come in. And, you know, arguably he goes too far with it. I do think in recent years, I've kind of, and certainly in this podcast, and in listening to some of the kind of later Big Finish stuff with Lala Ward and Tom Baker, I'm saying, yeah, the second Romana is just a bit of a prick, though.
Like, oh, really?
I just often find her just a little bit, I don't know, rude and... I don't know, this is not a Romana 2 story, so I'll save that.
Yeah, there's certainly, there's. I mean, obviously it's a different actor and it's a different character, really. But yeah, there's definitely a change to, and I think maybe there is something to the detriment there, is that because they don't want it to be a buddy comedy, they still want that kind of nurturing doctor to the companion vibe. They kind of rejig the character so that, even City of Death, she's literally dressed as a schoolgirl to give this idea of it's the Doctor is the lead educational force to this petulant kind of schoolgirl, as opposed to a lot of the comedy coming from the Doctor biffing up against somebody who knows, if not the same, then let's face it, more than he does. Yeah. And he's constantly got to... Because I guess there's the danger of puncturing the Doctor's bubble, of making him... If there's somebody who's able to do the same as him without the fuss, it makes the Doctor look a bit special, ridiculous. Yeah. And I don't think it happens here. I think there's some good... They do it well. They have arguments. But it's not the John Nathan Turner 80s sort of arguments that happen in the TARDIS. It's, there's the, let me just bide my time. Let's find all these keys to time, and then she's gone. She's out of here. This is, this is fine. Because there's a nice bit where I think they're trying to land the TARDIS, and she there's some sort of comment like, oh, this seems very easy. And he just like shoots a look over at her, and it's just a kind of like, oh, come on, kind of loop. And I guess that's where it works as well, is that this, you know, as much as people are saying that there's a lot of kind of scenery chewing and going all out, there's also some very subtle stuff as well, you know, like just like great little camera shots and movements and looks and eye rolls and expressions and things that really, again, I think, proved the point that somebody like Tom Baker was enthused by this series, by this script.
Yeah, I think he's definitely grabbing hold of it with both hands. Like, he seems to be looking at the guest cast. That's always a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's looking them in the eye. You know, he's you know, having a conversation with them. I mean, he just gets some just absolutely wonderful stuff to do. Like, I love the the resolution of the part three cliffhanger where he's made to walk the plank.
Yeah.
And he's just like got like a little remote control hologram thing that he's just, and he's just like talking to his own hologram.
Yeah, and it's
just,
that's good.
Just a load of nonsense, but it's really funny.
But then that comes just before the really great reveal.
Yes.
Because I didn't know anything about who the nurse was. So it did come as a surprise. But I did keep noticing, going, Christ, that's such a thankless task, that nurse role, isn't it? I mean, fuck me. I mean, it's just like, and then it comes with this great reveal of going, oh my God, it's like some sort of a hard light hologram that's building itself into existence. It's like that. And that's a great Douglas Adams bit, where out of flippancy comes the actual core of what this scene and this story is about. I did enjoy that. And the turnaround of the pirate, the captain, being in his own way a goodie trying to survive is such a great turnaround. And, you know, then when, yeah, and then like a great scene where when Mr. Fibulae dies, there's almost a kind of, am I going to say a homoerotic kind of thing? There's almost a kind of real, like a deep, male on male love.
Yeah, there's a I think there's maybe a bit more to their relationship.
Yeah, there's something. And the parrot, when K-9 kills the parrot,
it shits lasers.
Yeah, it is shitting. It is
shits laser. I mean, it's not shit lasers.
It's very obvious that it is coming from its backside as it attacks.
I had completely forgotten or had just not twigged that until I watched it this time around. I was like, wait a minute. I always thought the lasers came from the little...
from his little beak.
Mouthpiece.
No. It comes out his arse.
But no, it comes out his arse.
He's
shitting lasers down on K-9.
He is.
For the most... one of the most ridiculous scenes in all of Doctor Who, I would say.
It is, but... could have been so much worse. A flying robot parrot attacking people. It's actually very well done when it flies up and attacks things, and then, you know, it's there's a lot of stuff that could have been, considering that this was quite the original draft of this story was apparently unfilmable, and Anthony Reed had to work with Douglas Adams about taking it right down to a lot of stuff that was achievable on a BBC budget. There's a lot of stuff here which is pretty, could have been worse, but it's pretty well done.
Yeah.
The guards and their laser guns could have been so embarrassing, but it's actually very well shot so that
it does kind of work.
Guys going bleh, bleh, bleh with a laser gun, or when the Mentiads, who are all just a bunch of absolute Herberts.
The Mentiads are rubbish. Yeah. They are rubbish. Two of the cliffhangers revolve around the Mentiads staring at Tom Baker in a slightly...
we've come for you,
annoyed
Doctor.
Annoyed fashion?
Yeah. But there's just something about the way it's all filmed by Penn and Roberts. Who, fun fact, is the only director to have worked in Doctor Who in the 70s and the 80s.
Well, as a director, presumably, because I suppose Graham Harper... is he not... does he? No, he's not on this, is he?
Graham Harper.
Is he not like a product? No, maybe not this story. But he's obviously, he's kicking around.
Yeah, he's the only, Penn and Roberts is the only, he directed 70s stories and he directed 80s stories. There's loads of stuff that could have been shit. Like, when the Mentiads try and crush two guards with an appallingly undangerous rock fall. But it stays on the right side of this was terrible looking.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you watched it, but on BritBox, The stuff on film looks amazing. Like
I watched on DVD, but yeah, it did look pretty good. However they've mastered it for the DVD release. Because I'd kind of forgotten that actually any of it was shot on film. I always just thought it was all studio stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd forgotten about the power station. I'd forgotten about the caves, that kind of cliff top forest. I'd forgotten all about that stuff. And it looks great. You're right.
Yeah, it does. You know? And there's a weird kind of like crispness to it. And I don't know. I also like the fact that, there is a lot of scenery chewing going on. But then it's explained that is, like the captain is screaming and yelling and shouting. But then it's explained his bluster is purely to detract Xanxia from sussing out what his actual motivation to try and kill her is. And you just think, that's pretty good. Like, that's, you just think, oh, this is terrible casting. And he went, no, this is not. This is great casting. And the sheer energy that is required for this character to what a nightmare. You know, there's having half of your body as a robot. But what's worse, that you've got to, like, get up every day and yell at everybody just to keep your mind safe.
And you don't really actually have control of that other half of your body.
Yeah, she does.
The nurse
kind
of has control of it. Xanxia has control of it. There's so many layers and ideas in this script.
Yeah.
That I think, could make Doctor Who stories in their own right, but instead they kind of come together to make this incredibly entertaining story about kind of totalitarian regimes and the promises that they give to their people and how far do you question that? How far do you question this kind of position that you're in? That's a great element of it. Just the idea, I love the idea of a planet that can move through space and swallow up other planets and sort of condense them for sort of precious minerals and jewels and whatever resources it needs from it. That's a really great sci-fi idea as well. I don't know how much the Mentiads improve the story. I think that's my one kind of thing where I'm a bit like, I don't quite see what they're bringing to the party other than the exposition, really, I guess, about Xanxia and the history of the planet itself.
It's just diversionary tactics. It's who are the baddies here? To preserve the fact, to put, along with the captain, two quite over the top, strange looking possibilities as to who are the real baddies, to just keep the nurse in the background unnoticed long enough that nobody suspects until episode 4. Wow, I see what's happening here. My favorite story about Xanxia in doing the research for this is that, the old woman who is the actual Xanxia in the last moments of her life. That actress, they wanted her to take her false teeth out to make her look even more old and husk-like. And she was like, but you're going to have to pay me an extra 80 quid to take my teeth out. So she wangled 80 extra quid out of the production just to
fair
remove
player.
Her false teeth. So
that is a good showbiz anecdote. I like that.
Yeah.
I'll remove my false teeth, but it'll cost you 80 quid.
It'll cost you. I did. I really enjoyed this. I can see the problems a lot of people have with it. But I would just felt because it's new. And it was really interesting. I felt really well disposed to it, and the stuff that the pluses outweigh any of the minuses. And it was interesting. It was interesting that it was almost like a version of the Rebos operation done well. It looks like they share a lot of the same sets, and there's a lot of the same kind of like start to the story. It's a small medieval-esque kind of village that the Doctor and Romana seem to show up in, and then they spend a lot of time just walking in the nondescript corridors.
Yeah.
Meeting extravagantly dressed individuals whilst, you know, strange business deals and Holmesian-esque characters make galactic plans. And then they do more with it. Then where the Rebus operation didn't really get out of first gear, the pirate planet just went, yeah, but now, but what if all of this then took place as well?
I just
feel like the Doctor got loads to do. Like, he felt like a scientist in this. There's a lot of technological gobbledygook, but he felt like somebody who, rather than just a fucking chancer, actually has an arsenal of intense and fierce knowledge and intellect at his command.
Well, it's the fact that they kind of incorporate the TARDIS as part of the kind of solution to the story. To say, well, what if we materialize the TARDIS in the same place as the planet, and we can bounce it?
Yeah, this is sort of
back
it is
where it came from.
This is where you get something that is now standard in Doctor Who fan takes. In like spin-offs or people's that the TARDIS is not just the doorway that gets you from A to B. It's not just the thing where
it's
you
a
start
functioning spaceship.
Yeah, that
or
there's
a time machine. Yeah,
yeah, and that there's all kinds of rematerialization trickery that goes on, because isn't there something in the Creature from the Pit where the TARDIS is rematerializes around something to make something happen, and that Douglas Adams gives the TARDIS as the problem.
There's a lot of TARDIS stuff in Shadow, isn't
there?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you've got two TARDISes. One is the whole side of a building, you know. Douglas Adams gives that the TARDIS could be the technological answer to the puzzle. He gives that idea to Doctor Who. Because I think he's the first one to be fascinated by, wow, an infinite time capsule. You know, as opposed to just going, should we just walk around it, make it look a bit like a Victorian hospital, and be chased by Sontarans?
Yes. But no, I thought that was interesting, the use of the TARDIS in it. And like you say, how Adams kind of, I think, gravitates towards that as an interesting element of the show.
Yeah.
The other thing I guess maybe we should discuss is how this balances comedy with the slightly darker elements. Now, perhaps they're not as overtly dark as they are in The Girl Who Died and The Woman Who Lived, but obviously, as Lewis has pointed out, you know, they are committing genocide. They are wiping out whole planets in the search of... And it's the fact that I guess it kind of gets away with it in the sense that the Doctor and Romana only discover it when it does this to an uninhabited planet. So that you don't have the question over what they've done to the other planets until kind of towards the end, where the Doctor finds that trophy room and they're planning to sort of do the same thing to the Earth.
Yeah.
By which point it's kind of amped up the drama and kind of dialed down the comedy. You know, you as a comedy guy,
Well, they very deftly avoid the conversation. We're told that Calufrax is not inhabited. But yeah, they don't really talk about any of the other stuff. And it's quite glaring that when the Doctor is annoyed by all of this, he's more annoyed at what they've been doing with the engineering, the placing the planets in stasis, and why would they do that as opposed to what has happened, which makes me think, so were any of them inhabited? You know, because
I think there was a line in that speech about
when they talk about the Gestalt and this growing idea of the life forces of these destroyed things, essentially providing the reason for the Mentiads, the kind of the growing of this of the Mentiads' power, they're also very careful never to say that the life force comes from any dying beings. It's about the dying conversion of energy that exists within the planet, but they never say it's because of the specific lives of animals or sentient beings. Does it feel like when they select Earth that they have, that seems like it's the first time they're having the conversation about it is inhabited, you know, sir?
Well, because at that point you've not seen them implement their whatever, you know, their procedure for jumping the planet, because what you turn up just after they've swallowed up Caliphrax.
Yeah.
So this is the first time you kind of see the captain, Mr. Fibbley, and the nurse kind of discuss what it is they're about to do. Like I say, I do think there was a line or two in the doctor's confrontation with the captain, but you're right, it's quite, they play it down, and it's only by throwing the Earth in there, as I guess something for the audience to relate to.
Yeah.
As like, oh my god, this is what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't know if
this is something that needs to be stopped. Sorry, when it was just uninhabited planets, I didn't really care.
Yeah.
But now that I know it's an inhabited world, this is quite barbaric and horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know, but then you have to really, if that's the story you're going to tell, then you really have to choose the tone that you know, you'd be very careful with how you tell that story. And I think the starting point was that it was supposed to be a comic tale of ideas rather than any kind of like treatise on what if somebody took essentially mining equipment and destroyed lives with it. You know, like that's not what it is. But yeah, I don't know, mate. I've just felt like maybe the first time. Because how many planets have they destroyed? Is it something like five or something, isn't it?
Six or more, I think.
Five or six, yeah, okay. I don't know, I mean, it's interesting. And yeah, it's absolutely fair comment, like what is happening. But it feels, and if it is that some of them are inhabited, it feels very odd the Doctor wouldn't make that the main reason to be angry and to stop what's going on.
Well, I mean, arguably it is because it's Earth, but
it is. But he's already involved in trying to stop them before that, you know. Yeah, it's just that there's the whole Earth thing is something that the audience know well before the Doctor.
Because he says, what is it? He says he does say this is like, what is it, the most horrific crime committed in the galaxy or something when they're at the. So he understands what they're capable of. He doesn't necessarily understand how many planets they've done it to, but he understands that if they can do that to an uninhabited world, what the hell could they do to one that is populated by people? So I think he does understand the stakes, but it's not really until that kind of confrontation, you know, appreciate it.
Yeah.
So good. It's not until then, and the fact that it's Earth, that I think that he properly gets behind it, which is maybe problematic, I don't know, but I think it works. I think, you know, yes, it's a laugh.
Yeah.
But there's stakes there, and I don't think it ever really loses sight of the stakes.
Well, it rattles along. The thing about having a lot of ideas in a Douglas Adams script is that there's no real lull. Like, there's always stuff happening. The story's always moving forward. There's always some character somewhere trying to achieve something. So it's not a boring watch. Like, it's quite an exciting watch. And I really enjoyed it. And I hope that we hit more Key to Time stories in the next wee while. Because it's, like, this kind of, weirdly, this Graham Williams era, I don't know much about it. I haven't really invested a lot of time going through this.
Yeah, I watched the Key to Time. It's weird. So I think I got a couple of the videos. I think I got the Power of Crawl, which actually I've got up there somewhere on my shelf, signed by John Leeson, on VHS. And the Armageddon Factor I bought. But I think that, and I think I, and like I say, I watched the Pirate Planet with a friend of mine. But then I think it wasn't until that box set came out where I kind of watched the whole thing in order. But I don't really remember fucking anything about it. especially those later ones like Androids of Tara to
yeah, Androids Armageddon of Tara.
I don't really remember anything.
Yeah, that's another one that I think I'm going to say I haven't seen. Because right. I just remember nothing about it through whatever hungover haze. I was probably half watching it at 6:30 a.m. on UK Gold.
Because I remember at one point kind of saying that, oh, you know, Power of Crawl, people give it a hard time. But actually, I think it probably is shit because I don't really remember much about it. but I'm sure we'll come to them in the fullness of time. Are we doing favourite scenes, favourite performances? Is that what we're
doing? Yeah, I think.
I'm just looking at the clock as to how much time we've recorded. I'm like, could I edit this into just one full episode? Who knows?
Nah, man, we started recording at 9 and it's midnight now. That's...
It's 2 hours 45 minutes.
Okay, well, favourite scenes, favourite performances. So, like loads of people. Mary Tam, Tom Baker, yeah. Bruce Purchase. There's a lot to enjoy here. And my favorite, what is my favorite scene? I don't know. Yeah. Like, then what's it for? Is a great scene.
It's good. It's very good. I like that. I like the, excuse me. Have you seen a planet called Calufrax? It was just around here a minute ago. Love all that stuff. That's really good. I just like the doctor turning up. I thought I'd written down some of the dialogue. But I don't think I did. But when he first turns up at the house where I've forgotten his name now, who is about to become a Mentiad, basically. There's a lot of really fun Tom Baker dialogue in that. And I like just the doctor turning up in somebody's house going, oh, hello, you seem to be suffering some kind of problem. Can I help you in any way? There's some really good Tom Baker stuff in this. I think you're right. I think he's really kind of buoyed by this sort of amount. Because he became like really great friends with Douglas Adams.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can see why. I can see those two as people that kind of have a similar outlook on things and a similar kind of, I don't know, fascination with the universe and the sort of strangeness of.
Well, I think Douglas Adams entirely gets the character of the Doctor, and I think Tom Baker certainly appreciates a writer who gives him good material.
Yes, yeah.
I think there's a kind of mutual flattery thing going on there. I think. Well, there we are. That's the Pirate Planet. That is the Pirate Planet, and I'm glad I got to get to see that. That was good.
I'm glad you enjoyed that.
Next time we've got it's the Zygon invasion and the Zygon inversion. And we haven't talked. What are we pairing it with?
Well, we should if we can get it to work. Now, Ben, I'd like to say we were the original Edinburgh Doctor Who podcast. I might be wrong, but I feel like we were, right? And since then, you know, there have been others.
It's become a crowded market.
There's been Richie with I Hate Doctor Who, and there's been the Polish Box with our good friend Lee and Dave and Cameron. And we, you know, you and I no longer live in Edinburgh, and there was a truce. A truce was settled between all the Edinburgh Doctor Who podcasts. But that peace is starting to fracture. And so next time, we're going to sit down, you and I, with Lee, Dave and Cameron of the Polis Box to discuss the Zygon invasion and the Zygon inversion in a kind of Edinburgh Doctor Who podcast doppelganger smackdown. Won't that be fun? As a little precursor to our 100th episode celebration.
Yeah, that sounds fun. That sounds good. And what are we going to pair it with then? What are we?
Well, so I don't know. So obviously we've already done Terror of the Zygons.
Yeah.
So, not that. I had thought about the mutants.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a kind of political edge to it. A kind of social equality message to the story. So that was my suggestion. I don't know what you'd thought about.
I had not given it any thought whatsoever. It's been quite a busy week, so I didn't do as much kind of forward planning for this as I would have ideally have liked. One of the things that fell by the wayside was going.
I should say.
Thanks very much, but one of the things that fell by the wayside was, what do we do with the Zygons? So I'm happy to go with the mutants.
Yeah.
Because yeah, there is something about particular takes on British experience with foreign bodies in the ages that each of these things were made that would be interesting to talk about, particularly now when, in order to distract from increasing infections and COVID deaths, we're back to, oh, there's foreigners landing on the beaches and Nigel Farage is posting photos of folks climbing off a door and then going, ah, it's the end of the world. And it's like, oh, are we here again?
Oh, I wish it was, do you know what I mean? I'm just tired.
So yeah, let's do the mutants. That sounds good, let's do the mutants.
All right. So yes, so we'll be back with the Polis Box. We're going to sit down and talk, as Peter Capaldi advises us to do at the end of the Zygon Inversion. And hopefully we'll put aside our differences. So that should be fun.
Sounds good
then,
to me.
Yeah, after that will be our 100th episode.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it. We've got some nice things planned.
We do.
Thank you as always for listening. If you want to make as we said, are you enjoying these two-parters? Would you rather we just nailed them back together into one bumper episode? Comment?
Lee and the Polar Spots guys did a 3-hour podcast about Colony in Space, so you're going to want us to do a two-parter.
Wow. 3 hours around Colony in Space. Christ almighty. Facebook and Twitter, as always, is the place to air your views. Tell us what you think for listener correspondence. I've been Ben, and this has been, as always, a pleasure.
I've been Mark. This has also been a pleasure. And to play us out, as ever, it's Mr. Kef McCulloch.